Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi, folks. It's Peter Bregan. I've got, once again, a wonderful guest for you. But before getting to her, here's a subject that I think she'll be able to help us shed some light on. Increasing reports emphasize how much foster children in America are getting drugged. The rates vary from 100% seemingly in some areas of the country to 25% in others. Large numbers on antipsychotic drugs. And the bind the families are in are that if they don't take their children to the doc to get the drugs, they get in trouble as foster care parents. And as foster care parents, many of these people rely on the money they get to take care of the kids. Yes, hopefully they're devoted to what they do, but it's also a business. It's a way of making a living. Most people who take in foster care children are not earning a huge amount of money independently of that. And so if they don't bring their kids for medication, they'll lose the children that they want to help, and they'll lose the income. In addition, there are examples coming up increasingly of the fact that if they refuse to medicate, then they lose a portion of their income, because in some states, California, your worth of your foster child to you depends on how disabled they are, and as a part of that, how much medication there are. There are so many ways that drugs get forced on people. It's really quite an infinite network of oppression that grows out of the pharmaceutical industry and psychiatry. And the same thing happens to adults. If you're an adult on a disability and it has a psychiatric aspect to it, as growing numbers of disabilities do, then if you don't take your medication, you'll get reported as non-compliant. You're not getting your treatment. Therefore, you don't deserve disability. You can lose your disability. Now, as the alternative, you could go find a psychiatrist, perhaps. Maybe it would work to find one who didn't give drugs. Lots of luck doing that. So I think we'll get more information about things like this from my guest. Gretchen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Peter. Can you hear me?
I can. I hear a little knocking about on your desk, too. So there's a little interference, I think, there. Take a look and see if you're shuffling too near your microphone.
Okay. Is this better now?
Yeah, I don't hear a thing anymore, and you're clear. You actually have a very, very good sound, so that's really great. Well, Gretchen Lefevre Watson. Gretchen she's got like one foot in the establishment, one foot in academia. Then I think she's got several other feet. You know, she's a quadruped. She's got another foot in the public health arena, and she's just doing a lot of stuff. And it's going to be interesting to find out how she balances all of this. She has she publishes a lot. She's out in good journals. Her work gets discussed everywhere from Psychology Today to Popular Science and even the Weekly Standard, a conservative newspaper. That might be interesting to talk about, too. She has received the Healthcare Hero Award from Inside Business. And listen to this one. I'm jealous of this one. She's recently included in a prestigious list of 100 international scientists recognized by BMJ for their unbiased reviews of healthcare. Oh, you know what? I think I'm on that same list, come to think of it. I just realized what that list was. And it's a list for where journalists can go and get unbiased, factual, true reports. And in fact, I am on that list. That's funny, Gretchen.
So we have something more in common.
We do. She's president of Safety and Learning Solutions. And I'll let her tell you about that, but she actually gets money. Now, one area that I want her to talk about, we didn't discuss earlier in our pre-interview, and that is she's got a big grant, $16 million, to develop a workforce to support use of electronic health records in D.C. and 11 other states in the eastern region. And electronic health records are, I'm sure she'll agree, not entirely a blessing. She's very smart. She graduated summa cum laude from Boston University. She's got a doctorate in clinical psychology, and she's got a postdoc training. Here we get back into the heart of the establishment in pediatric psychology at Georgetown University Medical School. Gretchen has some really interesting things to say about ADHD and a variety of other subjects, so I hand the mic over to you.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's great to be here, and appreciate all your generous comments and just your dedication to trying to keep children as healthy as possible and away from as much medical harm as possible. So your work is incredibly important. It's an honor to be here. So where to begin? Gosh, there's so much to say about ADHD for sure. It's a topic that I never expected to be devoting decades of my life to. I just really accidentally fell into working on this topic, and that started way back in the early to mid-1990s when I was a full-time clinician at a medical school. And I had made the transition from working at the Naval Hospital out in San Diego as a civilian to working at a private medical school in Virginia when my family relocated back to the East Coast. And when we did that, I was scratching my head because I ended up in both places working at a hospital-based multidisciplinary clinic, in both places headed by the same pediatrician who had gotten out of the Navy and retired to Virginia, and we just coincidentally happened to move to the same area and live just a few streets apart, and he found out I was in town and said, you have to come back to work for me. And when I got to Virginia, so many of the children that I saw were coming in with concerns about ADHD or comments like, this child has ADD and has been taking Ritalin but is still having trouble, as if that was a mystery. And we didn't, I didn't at that time experience those kinds of issues in California. So I just started asking some questions and looking around, and it turned out that 75% of all the referrals to our clinic in Virginia involved concerns about ADD issues. And it didn't take me long to realize that children with all sorts of issues were getting called and labeled as having ADHD. So it could be anything from a genetic disorder to a problem in the home. I saw children who were psychotic who were called ADHD, children who were very significantly intellectually impaired but never diagnosed, who carried that diagnosis. So that got me to wondering, and long story short, I got up the nerve back then when I was still very new in my career and timid and shy to talk to one of the senior pediatricians at the medical school about how I might do some research to try to figure out what was going on in the community. And I ended up, at his request, writing a proposal. And I said, oh, gosh, I don't know how to do that. He said, answer five simple questions. And I did. And when I got the proposal back from him, it was covered in red ink, but he said it's one of the best research proposals he's ever written. You've got to do this study. And so that's how my career in ADHD research started. And we came up with some very powerful results back then. ADHD had been controversial back in the 70s and a blip in the 80s, but by and large had been in a period of quiet, and I was naive to the fact then of how controversial the diagnosis had been. But the study that we produced that involved 30,000 elementary school children was quite provocative, and we found that the rate with which children were being medicated in school back then was much higher than anybody in the establishment was acknowledging. And that study was published in the American Journal of Public Health, which is a very difficult place to get research published. But we had so much data that was so solid that the journal accepted it. After, interestingly enough, Pediatrics rejected it because the reviewer said it sounded as if the author was suggesting that Ritalin was being overused, which is, of course, exactly what we were suggesting. So anyway, what happened with me is that I wasn't ever interested in being a researcher for research's sake, so I wanted to know with this data in hand what we could do in the community to make things better. And I was fortunate enough to find other people and be mentored by other people at the medical school and in the community who had done a variety of public health interventions and who were willing to mentor me along. So we started designing intervention programs to reduce the diagnosis and perceived need for medication. So maybe I'll stop there and I could keep on going, but
Let's talk about those programs.
Okay.
Because one of the things we don't hear enough about is programs that work to help kids without the, you know, the ADHD and drugging, which just makes them toxic.
Right. Well, one of the things that we did, and we got a lot of funding from the U.S. Department of Education for this, surprisingly, was a school-wide positive behavior management program where we went into an entire elementary school district and we spent time training all of the teachers in the school and all the administrators on the use of kind of proactive, positive discipline strategies, if you will. And we were very careful about going about this, saying, look, we are not teachers, and you are, you know, they're the experts in what they do, but we're able with time to convince them that we have some expertise that we wanted to share with them because we thought they could put it to great use. For example, we spent a lot of time teaching teachers about why positive reinforcement, catching students doing the right thing and giving them, you know, a pat on the back or praise or pointing out why you were so pleased in them doing the right thing was important. Of course, we did pre-training assessments and post-training assessments, and we could show that teachers' knowledge increased. But at first, teachers said, you know, so they kind of gave the head nod. But when the rubber met the road, they would say things like, why should I have to, you know, praise Johnny for bringing his homework to school? That's what he's supposed to do. So we'd have to work through a lot of resistance issues like that, which we did by beginning to go into the classrooms, and we had observers who took the time and effort to write a handwritten note about something they observed the teacher doing really well that day in the classroom and putting it in her mailbox before they left. And once teachers started getting their own positive reinforcement, they became much more invested in the program. Then we talked to them about, you need to really build.
That's really brilliant, by the way. That's really.
Thank you. And I instructed them. I said, you may not tell them what you're doing. You're not going to say this is what you're going to do. You're just going to do it. Because here are the teachers in this classroom all by themselves all day long with these kids, and nobody's patting them on the back for what they're doing. Nobody's catching them doing things right. So, yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, they just responded so well, and it really helped the whole program take a turn for the positive. And eventually, we were able to say to them, this is the same that you can do for your students. So it was really a neat experience. We also talked to them about something as simple as using timeout. And almost all the teachers that were at that school said that they use timeout and it doesn't work. 96% of elementary school teachers report that they use it. Most say it doesn't work effectively. But what we did was then we went to each teacher's classroom and we looked at how they used timeout. And we found that 95% of them didn't actually have a place set up in their classroom that would enable them to use that strategy appropriately. So we worked with them to move, for example, file cabinets or desks or chairs around so that they had a space that could really serve as a functional timeout. And then we were able to explain some of these behavioral interventions are so simple when you understand them, but they're also simple to misapply. And once they, again, started using timeout effectively, they saw that it was quite powerful. And we had people with master's degrees go in and conduct the behavioral observations and of what was going on in the classroom, and we got them to be reliable to the 95% degree or higher. So all our data was really objective. And what we had at the end of the day were teachers who really bought into the program, they got it, and some who just refused. They were the naysayers. And at the end of the school year, without ever mentioning anything about academics, we were able to show that teachers who embraced the positive behavior management strategies had students who scored significantly higher on every academic subject area of the statewide standards of learning exams. And that was just amazing because we didn't have to do any academic intervention, but just by creating a more positive classroom environment, the children were more ready and were able to participate in the learning process.
What grade level was this, Gretchen?
This was kindergarten through fifth grade. All students, all teachers in an entire school.
And did you have any measures of its effects on behavior, on kids not ending up diagnosed ADHD, things like that?
Yes, we had at the beginning and at the end of the school year, we collected teacher behavior rating scales for every student. And we looked at ADHD symptoms at the beginning and at the end of the school year. And again, teachers who embraced the positive approach to behavior management had students who actually, as a whole, had decreases in ADHD symptoms, and those teachers who did not had students who, on the whole, from the beginning to the end of the year, exhibited more ADHD symptoms.
Were you able to correlate? You probably couldn't get the data for actually kids getting diagnosed and drugged and whether that changed?
Yeah, I couldn't. We didn't get that data. What we did, though, one other thing we had was we had overall at the school level, there was a 70% decrease in discipline referrals over the course of the intervention. But what we did have is as we were doing this work, we put together a whole coalition or task force that was open to the public to help guide everything that we did. And every study, every grant that I applied for, I built in an opportunity to conduct a population-based survey of the rate of diagnosis and treatment in the community so that we could monitor over time what was going on in our community. And what we found was before we started the actual community interventions, 19% of children in the southeastern Virginia area in grades 1 through 5 had been diagnosed with ADHD. By 2004, after we'd had several years of interventions, not only like the one I described in a particular school, but a lot of community-based interventions with parents and professionals, We saw a decrease of the rate to 14%. Again, still ridiculously high, but we had a 32% decrease over several years' period of time in the rate that children were being diagnosed in our community.
How long did the school intervention last?
The school intervention was designed to be 3 years altogether. The first year we had a pilot program at one school and then 2 years follow-on. And interestingly, at the end of the first year, teachers were begging us to come back. They started out not wanting us there, and they wanted to make sure that we weren't going to go away when the grant went away. But sadly, that work and all the work that I was doing got shut down right in the middle of it because of a malicious allegation of scientific misconduct. People, as you can imagine, Peter, with ties to the pharmaceutical industry, did not like my research and were, did what has been done to other researchers like me to shut the work down. And so it's a kind of a long story, but all of this work got disrupted beyond the point of repair.
Wow. Did you get published? Was it pulled out of publication?
Nothing got pulled out of publication that was already published, but we had three or four papers that were nearly finished. We were in the phase of amassing a huge amount of data that was going to lead to some really significant publications. In fact, we had finished a major portion of data collection from a grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that was a multi-site study in Virginia, Oklahoma, and North Carolina. And that study was really important because one of the criticisms that some people had about my research was they didn't like the way I worded survey items for establishing the rate of community-based diagnosis and treatment. So when I got the CDC funding, what I did was I used the exact wording that the CDC uses for assessing at the community level other chronic conditions like asthma and diabetes. We just substituted that diagnosis for ADHD. And what we found was that the rate of diagnosis in our community was the same whether we used the CDC wording or the wording on my prior surveys. And it was within one percentage point difference. That little bit of difference between 1 year and the next was probably, hopefully, related to the onward decrease in the overall rate that we were working on. So what that meant was it pulled the rug out from under those who were trying to discredit my research based on my methodology.
Were you able to track with any reasonable degree of certainty the source of the attack?
I can't say. I don't know for certain who is the ultimate source. The allegation was filed anonymously, and although it was filed anonymously and reportedly in a typewritten fashion, the medical school was never willing to release to me even an actual copy of the allegation that was submitted. And so I can only surmise people who might have been behind it, but I don't know for certain.
Yeah. Well, this is the history of psychiatry, which is that any solution which doesn't enhance the power of psychiatry and medicine, and now the pharmaceutical industry is crushed. It used to be that mainly innovations were going up against psychiatry, so that when you go back to R.D. Lang in that era, when there were so many marvelous hospital solutions in the 60s, hospital approaches that are more community-oriented and democratically oriented, and they're very successful. You have Lauren Mosier's early stuff where, you know, he shows you can treat psychotic people and their first breaks without drugs. The main opposition was from organized psychiatry, but compared to organized psychiatry, I mean, the drug industry is just a monster. I mean, psychiatry would like to be a monster, but the psychopharmaceutical industry is a monster, and that's more of the tone now. The situation now is that you're, when you come up with a psychosocial solution, then it's the pharmaceutical industry plus medicine and psychiatry that go after you. This is, folks, this is a story that's repeated again and again and again. And we really will never solve this by taking on the industry and psychiatry. We've really got to keep talking to the public and to the folks and to letting people know the truth about these kinds of issues, so that people just stop accepting anymore this form of enslavement to psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry. Really is an enslavement. We're enslaving our children to them.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And you've been aware of this for many more years than I have been, Peter. But it was only after my own experience that I learned how these orchestrated attacks on researchers who are producing results that run counter to the idea that drugs are our best option get attacked. And it's certainly well laid out in the very orchestrated pattern of attacks in a New England Journal of Medicine article that was published back in 1997. And somebody brought that to my attention along the way, and I read it, and I thought, wow, this is exactly what happens. And I had, you know, a colleague who was on a listserv who knew that it was coming, and he told me, watch out, you need to know about scientific misconduct, academic harassment, academic
stuff. It sounds like somebody's tearing your house down.
I'm in a Virginia Beach office, and that was one of our fighter pilots flying overboard. So when that happens next time, if I'm not talking, I'll try to put it on mute. So sorry about that.
Oh, that's all right. I mean, that's great. That's real life. But I literally thought somebody was dragging something through your office. And there's also some voice in the background. It's acceptable, but there is a sense of a little, activity going on around you.
Yes, I apologize. I don't actually have a landline in my office, so I borrowed somebody else's office.
I gotcha.
And there's a room next door, and there's somebody there who has a voice.
But your voice is very clear. What kind of line? Are you just on a telephone line?
Just on a telephone line. I've been told by an audiologist that I have what they call a thin voice that is perfect for microphones, but very difficult to hear in person.
Oh, that's so interesting, because your voice is gorgeous on the mic, and it's bright and clear, and it sounds like you have a fancy microphone setup or something. In the background, there's, you know, maybe a little war going on or something. But that was a jet. I've been in Virginia Beach. I was in Virginia Beach right around or shortly after 9/11. I was down there for maybe a trial, and then a lot of the flights going over D.C. were taking off from Virginia Beach, and the sound of these airplanes coming so low over the hotel and taking off to patrol the East Coast was just astonishing. So that's what that was. That was a fighter jet probably taking off.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, this is zip by. We're getting near the half hour. Very, very fast. And very important information for people. Folks, simple approaches to children work. Teaching parents and teachers to be more loving, to be more positive, to conduct themselves, I think, with more moral authority. I don't know if you address that with more certainty about their handling of the kids. It works. It works in every environment, from the home to the school, to the sports arena, and instead we're drugging our kids. I mean, it's just a shame. We'll be back in a minute or two, well, a few minutes, with Gretchen Lefever Watson. That's Gretchen, her middle name, capital L-E, capital F-E-V-E-R. That's, I got that right, didn't I? I mess up my guest names all the time. Watson, she's easy to find on the internet. And we'll go to some music and the break.
Positive.
Let's go from the kids today. Okay, are we back here? Am I on the air? I think I'm back on the air again. This is Peter Bregan, the conscience of psychiatry. And my guest is just a marvelous person, Gretchen Lefever Watson, clinical psychologist, but oh, so much more than that. During break, we were talking about, she and I, about other stuff that the teachers learned about handling children. And then I want to go with Gretchen from there to how that applies in her work as a consultant in the business community. And if we get a chance, we'll also talk about how college students are abusing the same drugs that we're giving our kids. So let's talk some more about what you were teaching the teachers about relationship with students that works, not just the positive reinforcement, the caring, the I prefer to call it appreciation. Howie Glasser, my friend, talks about, you know, finding the greatness and reminding the kids about their greatness, all these positive things. What else were you teaching the teachers about their power and confidence?
We recognized that building the teachers' confidence was as important as for us to do as it was for teachers to build students' confidence. So just like students responded very well to positive feedback, teachers responded very well to positive feedback. And along that same line, we realized that we needed to help teachers have the confidence to go ahead and set boundaries with students in their classroom, just like we want parents to set limits with their children in the home. And we told them, when you first do this in your classroom, one or more students will certainly test your boundaries. And if you set a limit, they will act up and act out at first. And then that behavior will disappear if you have the courage to kind of hold the line. So we would tell them, you know, take your time to think about what rules are really important for you to have in your classroom. If you could come up with only a small set of rules that would really make a difference, what would they be? And how can you teach students about them, put them in place, reinforce students for adhering to them, and take appropriate action when students don't. And that whole kind of sense of confidence and well-being on their own part was very important, because if teachers don't feel confident or they're not certain about what to do or not to do, children will pick up on that in an instant. They have a radar for that, and it makes them feel out of control. And when they feel out of control, they act out of control. So we went over that, and it was very interesting, Peter, that as part of this program, we also built in some parent training programs. But I really was hesitant about calling anything parent training, because most of the time when you talk about parent training or parenting classes, people feel like those are classes for the failures. And when you go to parenting classes put on in a community, so often you have two groups of parents: those who are court-ordered to go to parenting, or they might lose their children, or they might not get them back. And normally those individuals are in such a state of crisis that it's not a good time for them to be able to access information taught in a parenting class format. Or you have the really great parents who are really doing most everything any of us would like to do already, and they just want to make sure they're not missing out on anything. So I said, why don't we do this? Why don't we come up with a name for the parenting program that doesn't have the word parenting in it? And we came up with something called the A-plus Behavior Program, helping your student excel in school and at home. And it was just Parenting 101, but when I put together the materials and trained school psychologists to offer the program through their schools, we kept a bucket in the center of the table, and anybody who mentioned the word parenting had to put a quarter in the bucket. So we did the whole training, three 90-minute segments covering Parenting 101 without ever mentioning parenting or ever telling parents this is what you need to do, but helping them just focus on the behavior they really wanted to see from their child in the first place. And we had, at the end of three 90-minute segments in our A-plus basics, 100% of the parents wanted to sign up for three more sessions of what we called A-plus advanced. And what happened also was the teachers started hearing about this program, and they approached me and said, gee, do you think you could put one of those classes on for us? We don't really think we want to go be in the same program with our parents, or could we attend the program at another school? Because, as it turned out, people loved the program so much that five school districts said, we want you to train our psychologists. So I was in the process of training school psychologists from five school districts in southeastern Virginia on this A-plus behavior program. And they were eating it up. The parents were eating it up. People loved it, and they thought it was something new. And it was Parenting 101, just focused on positive behavior management. And you can see how powerful it really is and how much people really want that.
You know, it's just such a shame, and it's a reality. I mean, that's a part of the whole program that went down the tubes after the false allegations, isn't it?
Yes, it was. I was in the, I think it was training for the last segment of the program, setting up a train-the-trainer model so that this could become self-sustaining within this large geographic region without any additional funding, when I received a message that I was not to hold the training that next day.
Wow.
It was just, you know, horrible, and I wasn't allowed to. I would say that the medical school was asking me to not hold it, but I had to say that it couldn't be held. It was just a bunch of nonsense and legal maneuvering that was just horrible, and it left all of those psychologists stranded, and it put an end to the program.
Have you attempted to move on with these concepts and ideas, or have you left them behind and sort of just, you know, learned a lot from it? Have you tried to re-implement them anywhere?
I haven't tried to re-implement them. What happened was, it took almost 2 years to resolve all the shenanigans around the, you know, malicious attack on my research. And when that was over, I was pretty tired, but I figured that's what I would continue to do, that work. But I realized slowly that that was going to be virtually impossible in the community where I live, because of course, I'd been defamed in the newspaper. Big articles flashed across the front page of the Sunday newspaper, above the fold and across the fold, two whole pages in between. And a reporter who'd been going around for 6 months talking to everybody I collaborated with, frightening them that they might have done something wrong, so that everybody was afraid to pick up the pieces and continue on. So I finally, after about a year or so of thinking that's what I was going to go back to, I realized that unless I moved to another area of the country, it would be quite some time before the dust would settle enough. So I thought I was going to leave it behind, and I went off in another direction. And then Dr. Frederick Ernst, who you may know out at University.
Oh, yes, sure. Know Fred well. He's invited me to a couple of conferences. Of course, we met at one of those conferences.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Right. Well, all at once, Fred called me. I'd never met him. Alan Schwartz from the New York Times called me. And there was something else going on. They all wanted me to do something about ADHD, and it's been 5, 6, 7 years, and I hadn't done a thing publicly. I kind of occasionally would glance at an article, but really had set it aside. And somehow Fred talked me into giving a talk at his conference. And when I went to prepare for that and looked at what had happened in the almost 10 years since I had been doing research and when I gave the talk, I was horrified to see that things had just gotten so much worse. There was, yeah, things had gone from bad to worse. So I became reengaged in the process. And of course, I've heard, started to hear about more tragic stories of how these children who we've been drugging as preschoolers and elementary school children have been growing up and showing up on college campuses with their drugs in hand. And lo and behold, when you have huge numbers of college students walking around with prescriptions of stimulant medications that have a very high addictive potential, you have a recipe for disaster. And that's exactly what had happened. So when I had last looked at the data, around 2005, there was a small percentage of children, well, not small, but smaller percentage of children who were known to be abusing drugs. I think it was about 5% then. A few years later, it was up to 15%. And now we have at least a third of college students admitting that they abuse ADHD drugs, and 15% of those who do, crushing and snorting them in highly dangerous fashion, mixing them with alcohol and other drugs. And not surprisingly, now the rate of hospital visits for ADHD drug reactions has doubled between 2005 and 2010. Growing numbers of students are dying and becoming psychotic and committing suicide as a result.
Folks, we're listening to Gretchen Lefever, Lefever Watson. And, you know, one of the things I want to get at with you today and the people who are listening is that you have been living a principled professional life. And you've taken tremendous blows and attempts at humiliating you, but clearly you've survived with your ethics and principles intact. And that's the secret, folks. The secret is don't run and hide. Continue believing in yourself and in the truth. Would you address that, Gretchen? Because you've given such a poignant story of what happens to people who speak truth to power in any arena, and nowadays, especially where the pharmaceutical industry, psychiatry, and medicine is involved. I doubt very much that you regret anything you've done, but tell us about that. Tell us about what you've gotten from all this.
Well, thanks for asking. Nobody's actually ever asked me about that, but it really is important when couple things. One, no, I don't regret anything that I've done. And two, my experience is very clear why you should know what your ethics are and stick to them all along, because that is really what enabled me to endure this to a large extent. When I was going through it, and it was nasty, I mean, really very painful in a lot of different ways. At one point, the other side had 4 attorneys on my case. I was on administrative leave without pay, unable to pursue other work, or I would jeopardize my opportunity to have my name clear and get my job back, but unable to earn income and having to pay my own attorney. So it was very, very difficult. And what I just, you know, a phrase that would always pop into my head is make a joyful noise. And I just thought, you know, no matter what's going on, There is always a reason to be happy. And as painful as this all was, and can be even reflecting on it sometimes, I knew it was not personal, although it felt personal, and I would remind myself of that, that the attacks were very personal, but people were doing it not really because I was a bad person, but because they wanted my work and my voice to go away. And I just tried to remember that it's important to speak the truth, and so that's what I tried to do and try to continue to do. And as you know, Peter, it's very hard to get truthful messages out to the public. Our voices tend to get drowned by those who are connected to very powerful lobbying groups who hijack the media and hijack professional thought.
Tell us some about what you're doing now, and if you get a chance, about how all this applies to your consulting work.
Sure. Well, when I was doing this system-wide intervention to improve student outcome by affecting teacher behavior, somebody in a large healthcare system said, Gretchen, this is what we need to do with doctors and nurses in healthcare. There's this whole issue of patient safety that we, despite our best intentions, end up harming patients when we want to deliver good care. Apart from the issues of psychiatric drug use, there are times when, for example, you just administer the wrong drug by accident or the wrong dosage or a lot of different things happen. And can you help us shape doctor and nurse's behavior so that they deliver safer care? So I went to a corporate healthcare system from an academic medical center to help with that, and really had a great experience, had about 6 months of training with some nuclear power engineers and leaders in healthcare around the science of safety. And I tried to bring the behavioral science together with the science of safety to focus on what I call the human side of safety. And I absolutely loved the work, but I did not enjoy being part of a corporate healthcare system. So I thought what I would like to do is take those concepts out and create my own consulting business to do this work. And I thought that I would do it in nursing homes because nursing homes were being largely neglected in this area. But of course, I didn't realize at the time that nursing homes are neglected in part because they have no money. So this work is hard to get done there. But along the way, I was approached by the owner of a large industrial company about doing it for his company, helping them with improved safety. He had just heard me talk about it, checked out my website. I had no idea that this whole other industry was in such need of help. So I've started bringing the same concepts to bear in businesses of a variety of sorts. And it shouldn't be surprising, but it was to me at the time. Organizations are just so hungry for this same kind of help. So I begin that work with companies where they want to improve, for example, their safety records or their overall efficiency or improve their business outcomes by beginning with the leadership and helping them to understand that fundamental to any of those changes in a real significant and endurable way is focusing on developing respectful communication among the leaders in the company and then the next level of the company and all the way down till you get to people who are on the floor. And I've taught them that that's the hard work, and not because it's really the techniques are not hard, but it's overcoming our fear and resistance to change. But when they do that, then teaching the error prevention technique is actually easy. That's the part that doesn't take very long and isn't very hard to do. It's creating a culture that really supports people being helpful to each other, that makes a difference. and I'm just having a really fun time with it. They are very receptive and very grateful for the impact that it has on their business.
It's a universal phenomenon. For those of you who are new to the show, if you take away this one concept of respectful communication, communicating with others with respect, making clear that you only listen to respectful communications and that you want to encourage them, everything will change for the better with your children, your husband or wife, the students you're teaching, your patients, your clients. It is the beginning of good things. And when people treat each other with respect, it allows for the growth of fondness and love and caring. I tell my parents in my practice that the starting point of it all is respectful communication. And I'll bring together children and parents and in the office, and within 10 minutes have them communicating respectfully and teach them that this is the beginning, the absolute beginning. And once you have that, then you can talk about studies. You can talk about dinner time. You can talk about bedtime. You can talk about anything and work out issues. If you start with respectful communication, it is so key. And I'm just so glad to have you focusing on it. There are just a few universal principles to life, and I think, Gretchen, respectful communication is one of the biggest.
I agree with you, and your summary of how it applies to all those areas, I think you're right on the money.
We have about 5 minutes left. You mentioned earlier, used the phrase a joyful noise. Now, I do believe that's a Christian concept. Am I right about that? And are you spiritually oriented?
It is a Christian concept in that it is a phrase right out of Psalm 100 in the Bible. You don't necessarily have to be Christian to read that and have it make sense. And I particularly like that psalm because in the King James version of it, it also mentions that to remember that we have not made ourselves, but that we are all unique creatures. And I think that's so fundamental. That one psalm captures so many different things if you read the whole thing, which is quite short, but to make a joyful noise unto the Lord and be thankful for those things that we have, and to realize that we should not be too grandiose about ourselves, because those things that are great about us have been given to us, and not that we're not responsible for what we do have. So and to your other question, yes, I am a very spiritual person, and that certainly makes it easier to get through life. I don't have a probably very traditional approach to spirituality, although I don't even know what that means in this world today, but I just do believe in the power of people, and that there is powerful positive influence around if we choose to tap into it.
You there?
Let's put it on mute because we have another jet going over.
No, leave the jet in.
Okay.
We have 1 minute to go. Jets are flying. It's some sort of a sign. And if it's from Psalms, then it's a Hebrew concept and a Judeo-Christian concept, right?
Correct.
I didn't know where it was from. Well, listen, Gretchen, it's just been a joyful noise to have you on my radio show. Thank you so, so much. I wish you the very best in everything you do. And let's try to meet again at a conference in the future. You can find Gretchen easily on the website, on the internet, Gretchen Lefevre Watson. It's a name like none other, and it's a beautiful name. Any 30-second parting thought?
My parting thought would be thank you to you, Peter. It has been a real treat to be here and to hear your voice and to be part of your effort to continue to spread good words about what we can do to help each other and children that we care about so much.
And thank you to my wonderful audience. It's Peter Bregan with Gretchen Lefevre Watson saying bye for now. Thank you.